It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Another attack on the Somali presidential palace. Nigeria's government said to be closer to freeing those kidnapped schoolgirls. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Somali officials say the country's president and prime minister are safe following an attack Tuesday by militant group al-Shabaab on the presidential palace in Mogadishu. Witnesses reported explosions and heavy gunfire in and around the palace compound as several gunmen stormed the gates and tried to force their way inside. A security official is quoted as saying all 9 attackers were killed. Al-Shabaab has stepped up attacks on government targets in recent months. The Al-Qaeda-linked militant group first attacked the palace in February. The president was unharmed in that attack, but 17 others were killed. Nigeria's National Council of State is promising good news soon on the fate of more than 200 schoolgirls held captive by Islamist extremists for nearly 3 months. Governor Godwill Akpiabo says security agents are satisfied they know where the girls are located. Heather Murdoch reports.
Nigerian National Information Center coordinator Mike O'Meary says President Goodluck Jonathan is doing everything he can to save the kidnapped girls, and recent arrests have brought the military closer to a rescue.
He is working assiduously to ensure the rescue and safety of these children.
The military reports arresting, among others, one of the masterminds of the abduction, recruiters for the newly identified female wing of Boko Haram, and 2 foreign mercenaries. The military also reports killing at least 97 terrorists and losing 12 soldiers, including an officer. O'Meary says vigilante groups and average citizens are partially responsible for the recent success.
Citizens have joined the call for the president to intensify effort at finding a solution to the issue of insecurity in the Northeast.
But in the past week, the U.S.-based Council on Foreign Relations reports insurgents have killed at least 134 people. Also, more than 60 women who were kidnapped in mid-June escaped Boko Haram on their own. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Kenya's government says recent coastal attacks, including one in Mekaptoni and a nearby village in which 65 people died in June, were not carried out by al-Shabaab. Rather, they were the work of what are called local political networks. President Uhuru Kenyatta said the government has intelligence to back its claim.
Evidence indicates that local political networks were involved in the planning and execution of the heinous crime. This also played into the opportunist network of other criminal gangs. It is now clear that intelligence on this attack was availed to security officers in Mpeketoni. Unfortunately, the officers did not act accordingly. This negligence and abdication of duty and responsibility is unacceptable.
Coastal communities in Kenya have a history of land disputes among ethnic groups. Former parliamentarian Njeru Kathungu says the government needs to do a better job of providing security, whoever is responsible.
There is somebody somewhere in government who is not working properly. I don't want to name names myself, but it is a government responsibility to secure its people. A government that does not offer security for its people has got no business. And that is an issue that requires a lot of discussion.
Meanwhile, there were separate attacks Monday by unknown gunmen, one at a wildlife conservation center near the island of Lamu in eastern Kenya, and a restaurant in Arusha, Tanzania, both popular with foreigners and believed aimed at the two countries' tourism industries. 8 people were reportedly wounded in the restaurant bombing. It's not known if the attacks were coordinated. In Uganda, nearly 100 people are now said to have been killed in a series of attacks on security forces, which began Saturday near Uganda's border with Democratic Republic of Congo. President Yoweri Museveni says dozens of tribal gunmen used guerrilla tactics and looted weapons from soldiers and police in 2 western districts. He said the attacks in a 3rd district were repulsed. The Ugandan leader vowed to punish those involved. In World Cup action on Tuesday, Germany trounced host Brazil in a semifinal match 7-1 to advance to the championship game. They will face the winner of today's semifinal match between the Netherlands and Argentina, that championship game on Sunday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the 9th day of July, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan commemorates the third anniversary of its independence today, but is there anything to celebrate?
The people of the Republic of South Sudan, despite the rebellion, are ready to celebrate Independence Day in jubilation and happiness, and we believe that we will overcome the challenges we have.
Barnaba Merah Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. We'll hear the views of two analysts who say South Sudan's elite have failed their people. The United Nations provides support to the DRC government for its DDR program. And Somalia's president is said to be safe following an al-Shabaab attack on the presidential palace in Mogadishu.
We heard, big explosions, and there was major fight between soldiers and this guy, al-Shabaab, and it was happening right outside my window.
Hussein Arab Issed is a member of Somalia's parliament. The U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says Zimbabweans hold the key to their own future. And FIFA's Football for Hope tournament kicks off in Brazil as the World Cup nears completion. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan is today Wednesday commemorating the third anniversary of its separation from Sudan, but many say there's very little to celebrate in the midst of an ethnic-led civil war that has displaced much of the country's population, famine, and corruption. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Tuesday urged President Salva Kiir and rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar to live up to the expectations of their people by laying down their arms and returning to the negotiation table. Foreign Minister Barnaba Merah Benjamin says South Sudanese have a lot to celebrate because they have freedom. He tells me the rebels, whom he describes as troublemakers, have been obstructing negotiations aimed at ending the civil war.
The preparations are on time. It is a great jubilation that we are getting to the third year of our independence. The people of the Republic of South Sudan, despite the rebellion, are ready to celebrate Independence Day in jubilation and happiness, and we believe that we will overcome the challenges we have.
When you talk to South Sudanese, they say they don't have anything to celebrate on this anniversary. What do you want to say to the people of South Sudan?
That is not true. There is something to celebrate because we are a free nation. We have got our independence. There is no country on the continent that has had crises, including countries like South Africa, like Angola, like Kenya, like Nigeria. Everywhere there are problems. You don't forget the essence of your dignity and freedom. And that's what we celebrate. There are a few troublemakers among us. And we believe we shall overcome that political difference in which the rebellion is the problem that we have.
The Secretary General of the United Nations is calling on you, the government, and the rebels to live up to the expectations of the people of South Sudan, one, by laying down your arms and then returning immediately to the negotiation. Give me, from your government perspective, what is the hold up?
The hold up is the rebels are the one holding up the talks. They are the one who have stop the talks from proceeding ahead.
Well, the rebels, on the other hand, will say it's the government that's holding up the talks.
No, that is not true. Everybody knows that the government has not left the table. It is the rebels, especially the leader of the rebels, Dr. Riek Machar, who had written to the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who is the chair of IGAD, saying that they will not come to the talks if the stakeholders are included in the negotiation process. So the talks are held up because of the rebels' position, not the position of the government. And I think the Secretary General is aware of that.
The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, Hilda Johnson, is saying here that you, the South Sudanese elite, are responsible for the problems of the country. She accused the so-called South Sudanese elite of corruption, I would say. Is there corruption going on in that country?
We don't deny corruption anywhere, Mr. Buckley. Corruption is everywhere throughout the world, including where you are. But that cannot make people really forget the vision of their freedom. And the government is doing a lot in order to curb that corruption. And part of that corruption, that's why the government also was able to make some reshuffle, where some people were taken out of the government, where the process of changes were being done. This is an all-inclusive solution to all this criticism that was being labeled against the government. I think Heather Johnson had the right to her views. There is no question about that. But that, in fact, it is a political crisis that has come as a result of an attempted coup to change the government through the use of force. There is no elected constitutional government that can accept that to happen.
Mr. Minister, you're always kind, and I thank you very much for speaking with us again. And happy anniversary.
Thank you very much. That is the best news I've had from you now. Thank you.
South Sudan Foreign Minister Barnaba Merau Benjamin was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. As South Sudan commemorates the third anniversary of its secession from Sudan today, Wednesday, experts say President Salva Kiir has not lived up to the promises he made when the nation was born. Philip Aliu of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
James Alichigaran from the Juba-based think tank Ebony Center for Strategic Studies says President Kiir must do more to live up to the pledges he and others made when South Sudan was born.
We expect the president to reassure the nation that as soon as peace returns, he must work on economic issues, investing in agriculture, investing in infrastructure, such that each and every South Sudanese has a food on the table.
Ali says President Kiir promised on July 9, 2011, to build schools in all 10 states within 100 days. That has not happened. In fact, Ali says, since a peace deal was reached with Khartoum in 2005, and former rebels of the Sudan's People Liberation Movement started governing what was then semi-autonomous Southern Sudan, little has changed.
From 2005 all until today, President Kiir has been saying a lot of things that he later failed to deliver. He may say, yes, he's not the only one in the government, but he's the captain of the ship. The buck stops with him.
Agustino Ting Mayai of the SWAT Institute agrees with Alish. Mayai says President Kiir has to ensure that someone is held accountable for funds that have gone missing and for human rights abuses. He says even though most South Sudanese are in no mood for celebrating tomorrow, he expects things to change for the better.
Definitely given the historical records that are out there, people have the right to be pessimistic. But I think that given the crisis, there's potential for change in the country. And so we should be hopeful that even though the president has failed in some areas in the past, that we shouldn't always think that the future looks bleak because of that.
Mayai says he believes President Kiir will give members of the opposition a place in post-conflict government. After all, he has brought other armed groups that were fighting his government into the system before now. Mayai says rebels should not take a presidential amnesty for granted. In his fight of the many challenges facing the young country, both experts say South Sudanese are a resilient and forgiving people and are prepared to move on and celebrate the third anniversary of independence. But they also expect much more from their leaders. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu in Juba.
Somalia's al-Shabaab militants stormed the presidential palace in the capital Mogadishu on Tuesday in the second attack this year on the government compound. As VOA's Gabe Jaslo reports, President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed and his prime minister are reported to be safe, while militants and security forces were said to be among those killed.
Witnesses heard heavy explosions and gunfire coming from the presidential palace, known as Villa Somalia, in the evening, just as Somalis were sitting down to break their Ramadan fast. Member of Parliament Hussein Arab Issa told VOA he was inside the compound at the time of the attack.
We heard big explosions, and there was a major fight between soldiers and these guys, Shabab, and it was happening right outside my window.
Government spokesman Ridwan Haji told VOA's Somali service that the top Somali officials are safe and accounted for. The President, Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, the Prime Minister and other ministers are all safe, he said. I spoke to the Prime Minister and other ministers, and they are all fine. Haji said it is possible that one or two of the gunmen may have entered the compound, but that they did not succeed in their plan. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. A former government official in Mogadishu said the president was attending an iftar event at the fortified Mogadishu airport compound along with the presidential guard, leaving Villa Somalia more vulnerable to the attack. This is the second time this year that Al-Shabaab has tried to attack the presidential compound, which also houses government offices and residences. A suicide car bomb and gun attack on the site in February left at least 14 people dead. The Somali militant group, which seeks to impose its own version of Islamic law in Somalia, has also attacked the parliament building twice and has claimed responsibility for assassinations of government officials. An African Union peacekeeping mission in the country has reclaimed territory from al-Shabaab, But the militants continued to strike at government and international targets in the capital and increasingly in neighboring Kenya. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
It is Wednesday morning, July 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. The military spokesman for the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, known as MONUSCO, says the group is providing logistical support to help the government implement its disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, known as DDRO, of rebels who volunteer to lay down their weapons. Colonel Felix Bass tells reporter Peter Clotty the support includes transportation, shelter, food, as well as the health needs of the rebels who have surrendered.
Of course, within MONUSCO, in our organization, we have a section taking care of the DDRR, which is the disarmament, demobilization, integration, repatriation, and reinsertion. So MONUSCO has technical personnel ready to support the government of Congo, as stated in our last resolution, which is UN Security Council Resolution 2147. Following different ultimatums given by the Congolese government to all armed groups to lay down their weapons, FDLR, who fled from Rwanda following the 1994 genocide, the intention of laying down weapons and go through the demobilization process.
Colonel Bass, some people have expressed concern that their disarmament has been too slow for them to willingly hand over their weapons, so there is need for pressure to be put on them to hand over their weapons. So what do you say to that?
For that, I believe that everybody is getting fully involved in this process, particularly the special representative for the Secretary General, Mr. Martin Kobler, and his deputy, General Wafi, who is the chief of operations in the East. But also, we see the involvement of many stakeholders and many partners, but also some regional organizations like the International Conference for the Great Lakes Region, ICGLR, but also the SADC, which is the South African Development Community, who all are involved in trying to push the process to move forward so we have these people surrender peacefully.
What has been the response of residents in both North and South Kivu seeing some of these rebels who have attacked them in the past willingly surrendering and handing over their weapons?
This is a great relief for the population. But you see, the population of the Kivu have been suffering too long. So it is welcome. It is welcome because this can put an end to their suffering, their daily suffering. So they are welcoming the process. They are supporting all the people who are on the ground trying to push the process to move forward. At least they have some hope that this suffering will end up soon.
Colonel Felix Bass is the military spokesman for the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kinshasa. The United States ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton, says Zimbabweans hold the key to their future and that the U.S. stands ready to assist them realize their dreams. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Harare.
Speaking to editors in Harare, Ambassador Wharton described Zimbabwe as a country with a lot of potential, but said its economic success will depend on the policies the country will adopt.
And I believe further that Zimbabwe's future is very much in the hands of Zimbabweans. I think that Zimbabwe's own policy decisions are the primary drivers of the future of this country, whether it's the economic future or the social future or the political future. What really matters in Zimbabwe is what the government and the people of Zimbabwe decide to do.
Mr. Wharton said although the U.S. imposed sanctions on President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle, the measures could be reviewed in line with the developments that have taken place in Zimbabwe, such as the new constitution and the peaceful elections held last year.
I think that accountability matters. I think that values matter. I also think that it's very important for the United States to continue to review and revise those sanctions. Things that were appropriate in 2003 or 2008 may no longer be appropriate today. And to that end, I'd like to point to the fact that, in fact, our sanctions list is reduced, has been reduced. We're now at 106 individuals and 69 entities. I think it can go further in the direction of minimizing the number of people on the list.
Ambassador Wharton pointed out that President Mugabe will not be attending the U.S.-Africa Investment Summit in Washington later this month, as he is still on the targeted sanctions list.
Well, as you know, the deputy chair of SADC is on the specially designated nationals list, the SDN list, targeted sanctions list. And as such, it was the judgment of the White House that it was not appropriate to invite him.
On the political situation in Zimbabwe, Ambassador Wharton said most worrying is the fact that the main political parties in the country are self-consumed in internal politics at the expense of policy issues and are not presenting alternatives to the people of Zimbabwe. He said America is not taking sides in the movement for democratic change squabbles and is not funding any of the factions.
Specifically, we are being extremely careful not to take sides, the same way as in the internal dynamics of ZANU-PF. It is none of our business.
Former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is locked in a bitter power struggle with Secretary General Tendai Biti, who wants him out for incompetency and failing to beat Mr. Mugabe in the July 2014 elections. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
As excitement builds towards the final matches of the FIFA World Cup, another competition has begun in Brazil. The Football for Hope Festival brings together underprivileged young people from around the world for an event that is less about winning than about enjoying the game and one another. Scott Bob reports from Rio de Janeiro.
A sunny morning at the local sports center in Caju, a low-income neighborhood near Rio de Janeiro's Old Port. Teenagers from around the world are playing the sport they adore. Welcome to the Football for Hope Festival, sponsored by FIFA, football's world governing body that organized the 2014 World Cup. This is the other World Cup, said FIFA President Sepp Blatter during the opening ceremony.
What is exceptional here in this game, there are no referees. There is nobody to blame, nobody to criticize. And never you criticize the players. So it's really where football is played, the essence of football. It is a great game.
The festival has brought together 32 teams from 15 countries for 10 days of fellowship. They were chosen from more than 100 football-based programs sponsored by FIFA around the world. The program aims to encourage youth in marginalized communities to remain in school. In some communities, it educates them on topics ranging from HIV/AIDS to conflict resolution and youth leadership. FIFA has spent $36 million on the program since it began 9 years ago. After this week's inaugural game, Julian Leão of home team Vila Olímpica is exuberant. One of her opponents from the U.S.-based Starfinders team, Sydney Hennick, agrees.
It's been really amazing. We get to play from people all around the world. We haven't been able to play before. We do activities of team building and encouragement and respect, and we just get to play. Like, the outcome of the game isn't always just the most important thing. We play just to have fun.
Brazil's deputy sports minister, Luiz Fernandes, says football has done more for building international relations than decades of diplomatic negotiations. The four-day tournament brings teams from Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. It will end in the crowning of a Football for Hope champion. But for these young athletes, it is the journey that matters, not the winner. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Tuesday will remain a dark day in Brazilian football. Never before in the history of the FIFA World Cup has a host nation been so utterly humiliated. Germany crushed Brazil in the first FIFA World Cup semifinals in Belo Horizonte on Tuesday. The Germans went ahead with goals from Thomas Muller, Miroslav Klose, Sami Khedira, and two from Toni Kroos to take a 5-0 lead after 30 minutes. Then second half substitute Andre Schürrle added two more before Oscar pulled one back in the last minute of play as Germany overwhelmed Brazil 7-1. Staying in Belo Horizonte, a shell-shocked Brazilian coach Luiz Felipe Scolari took full responsibility for the unprecedented defeat in Brazilian football history. Addressing a post-match media conference on Tuesday, Scolari pleaded for forgiveness from the Brazilian public for this catastrophic result. He assures the public that they will honor their bronze medal playoff in the capital, Brasilia, on Saturday. Still in Brazil, Argentina play the Netherlands in the second semifinal in Sao Paulo today, Wednesday. Argentina seek to advance to their first World Cup final since 1990, while Netherlands aim to secure their second consecutive appearance in the World Cup finals. The two captains, who are both strikers, are in contrasting form ahead of this crucial tie. Argentine captain Lionel Messi has scored four of his team's eight goals. He told the media in Sao Paulo that he's focused on the team's success and would rather win the World Cup instead of him winning the Golden Boot, an accolade for the top goal scorer at the World Cup. Meanwhile, Netherlands skipper Robin van Persie has scored three goals but may miss the match as he is reportedly suffering from a stomach ailment. Finally, in boxing, Kenyan Daniel Wanyonyi is the new Africa Boxing Union light heavyweight champion following his split decision victory over the Democratic Republic of Congo's Maitamba Debach Postolo in the capital, Kinshasa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Aliyu Sano of Juba, South Sudan. He says, Dear VOA, West Africa is presently faced with three crises, namely Boko Haram in Nigeria, the Ebola virus in the Manu River Union countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone and Guinea, and the Tuareg Rebellion in northern Mali. There must be a political goodwill in order to address these challenging moments. I hope the governments of the Economic Community of West African States will find a speedy solution to these crises. Thank you, Aliyu Sano of Juba, South Sudan, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somali officials say the country's president and prime minister are safe following an attack by militant group Al-Shabaab on the presidential palace in Mogadishu. Witnesses reported explosions and heavy gunfire in and around the palace compound late Tuesday afternoon as several gunmen stormed the gates and tried to force their way inside. The witnesses also said the gun battle died down by early evening. In a series of Twitter messages, the president's office said the attack on Villa Somalia has been foiled and the area is secure thanks to Somali Army and African Union forces. That's it for this Wednesday, July 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jamin Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa. But please stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
Wake, 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 wake. Umaru, wake.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.